Chapter 4. The Singapore Sling. Even as we neared withdrawing from the wretched Iran nuclear deal, Trump's focus on North Korea's nuclear weapons program resumed. The more I learned, the more discouraged and pessimistic I became about a Trump-Kim summit. I was deeply skeptical of efforts to negotiate the North out of its nuclear weapons program, which Pyongyang had already sold many times to the U.S. and others in exchange for economic benefits. Despite breaching its commitments repeatedly, North Korea always cajoled a gullible America back to the negotiating table to make more concessions, ceding time to a proliferator which invariably benefits from delay. Here we were at it again, having learned nothing. Worse, we were legitimizing Kim Jong-un, commander of the North Korean prison camp, by giving him a free meeting with Trump. It called to mind Winston Churchill's dark 1935 observation about Britain's failed policies toward Germany. When the situation was manageable, it was neglected. And now that it is thoroughly out of hand, we apply too late the remedies which then might have effected a cure. There is nothing new in the story. It is as old as the Sibylline books. It falls into that long, dismal catalog of the fruitlessness of experience and the confirmed unteachability of mankind. Want of foresight, unwillingness to act when action would be simple and effective, lack of clear thinking, confusion of counsel until emergency comes, until self-preservation strikes its jarring gong. These are the features which constitute the endless repetition of history. Having endured 8 years of Obama mistakes, which I constantly feared would include dangerous concessions to North Korea, as his Iran policy had, not to mention the Bush 43 administration's failed six-party talks and Clinton's failed agreed framework, I was sick at heart over Trump's zeal to meet with Kim Jong-un. Pompeo told me that Trump's fascination with meeting Kim dated to the administration's outset. Clearly, the options were very limited. On April 12th, in the midst of the Syria whirlwind, I met with my South Korean counterpart, Chung E-yong, director of their National Security Office. In March, in the Oval, Chung had extended Kim's invitation to meet to Trump, who accepted on the spur of the moment. Ironically, Chung later all but admitted that it was he who had suggested to Kim that he make the invitation in the first place. This whole diplomatic fandango was South Korea's creation, relating more to its unification agenda than serious strategy on Kim's part or ours. The South's understanding of our terms to denuclearize North Korea bore no relationship to fundamental U.S. national interests, from my perspective. It was risky theatrics, in my view, not substance. I urged Chung to avoid discussing denuclearization at the upcoming April 27th North-South Summit to prevent Pyongyang from driving a wedge between South Korea, Japan, and the U.S., one of its favorite diplomatic strategies. I told Trump that we needed the closest possible coordination with Moon Jae-in to avoid North Korea's engineering a split between Washington and Seoul. I wanted to preserve U.S.-South Korea alignment and avoid the headline, "Trump rejects South Korea compromise," but he seemed unconcerned. Later in the morning, I met with my Japanese counterpart, Shotaro Yachi, who wanted me to hear their perspective as soon as possible. Tokyo's view of the looming Trump-Kim meeting was 180 degrees from South Korea's. In short, pretty much like my own. Yachi said they believed the North's determination to get nuclear weapons was fixed, and that we were nearing the last chance for a peaceful solution. Japan wanted none of the action-for-action formula that characterized Bush 43's failed six-party talks. Action for action sounded reasonable, but it inevitably worked to benefit North Korea, or any proliferator, by front-loading economic benefits to the North, but dragging out dismantling the nuclear program into the indefinite future. the marginal benefits to Pyongyang of even modest economic aid or release from pain, like easing sanctions, was much greater than the marginal benefits to us of the step-by-step elimination of the nuclear program. Kim Jong-un knew this just as well as we did. At that point, Japan wanted dismantlement to begin immediately upon a Trump-Kim agreement and to take no longer than 2 years. I urged, however, based on the experience in Libya, that dismantlement should take only 6 to 9 months. Yachi only smiled in response, but when Abe met Trump at Mar-a-Lago the following week, see Chapter 3, Abe asked for dismantlement to take 6 to 9 months. Yachi also stressed North Korea's abduction of Japanese citizens over many years, a powerfully emotional issue in Japan's public opinion and a key element in Abe's successful political career. At Mar-a-Lago and later, Trump committed to pursuing this issue and following through faithfully in every subsequent encounter with Kim Jong-un. Pompeo, the administration's initial contact for North Korea as CIA director, was already negotiating the summit's venue and date, and the prospect of releasing 3 American hostages. Kim wanted the meeting in Pyongyang or Panmunjom, both of which Pompeo and I agreed were non-starters. Pompeo saw Geneva and Singapore as the 2 most acceptable choices, but Kim didn't like to fly. North Korea's rickety airplanes couldn't reach either city anyway, and he didn't want to be too far from Pyongyang. My hope? Maybe the whole thing would collapse. At Mar-a-Lago, Abe spoke at length about North Korea's nuclear program, stressing, as had Yachi in our earlier meeting in Washington, that we needed a truly effective agreement, unlike the Iran nuclear deal which Trump had so frequently criticized and which the Obama administration itself had emphasized was not even signed. Of course, Pyongyang was just as capable of lying about a signed as an unsigned document, but it might just trip them up. Abe also urged Japan's long-standing positions that, in discussing ballistic missiles, we include short- and medium-range missiles, which could hit significant parts of Japan's home islands, as well as ICBMs, which the North needed to hit the continental United States. Similarly, Japan also wanted to eliminate the North's biological and chemical weapons, which I agreed should be part of any agreement with Pyongyang. Trump asked Abe what he thought of Kim's recent visit to see Xi Jinping in China, and Abe said it reflected the impact of America's implicit threat to use military force and the cutoff, under international sanctions, of much of the oil flow from China. Abe emphasized that the U.S. strike against Syria a few days before had sent a strong signal to North Korea and Russia. Kim Jong-un's father, Kim Jong-il, had been frightened when Bush 43 included the North in the axis of evil, and military pressure was the best leverage on Pyongyang. I thought Abe's convincing presentation would sway Trump, but the impact turned out to be limited. The Japanese had the same sense that Trump needed continual reminders, which explained why Abe conferred so frequently with Trump on North Korea throughout the administration. On April 21st, the North announced with great fanfare that it was foregoing further nuclear and ballistic missile testing because it was already a nuclear power. The credulous media took this as a major step forward, and Trump called it big progress. I just saw another propaganda ploy. If the necessary testing were now concluded, Pyongyang could simply complete the work necessary for weapons and delivery system production capability. Chung returned on April 24th before Moon's inter-Korean summit with Kim at the DMZ. I was relieved Chung contemplated that the leader's Panmunjom declaration would only be 2 pages, which meant whatever it said about denuclearization could not be very specific. I sensed that South Korea believed Kim Jong-un was desperate for a deal because of the pressure imposed by sanctions, and that economic development was the North's top priority now that it was a nuclear weapons state. I did not find this reasoning comforting. Meanwhile, Pompeo was narrowing the options on timing and location for the Trump-Kim meeting, probably June 12th or 13th in either Geneva or Singapore. The April 27th Moon Kim Festival at the DMZ had everything but doves with olive branches flying around, but was actually almost substance-free. On Friday morning Washington time, I gave Trump a copy of a New York Times op-ed by Nick Eberstadt, one of America's most astute Korea watchers, which rightly called the summit P.T. Barnum-style, a sucker-is-born-every-minute diplomacy. I didn't think Trump would read it, but I wanted to emphasize my view that South Korea's agenda was not always ours, and that we needed to safeguard our own interests. Fortunately, the Panmunjom Declaration was remarkably anodyne, especially on the nuclear issues. Moon called Trump on Saturday to report on his talks. He was still ecstatic. Kim had committed to complete denuclearization, offering to close their Punggye-ri nuclear test site. This was just another sham concession, like blowing up the Yongbyon reactor's cooling tower under Kim Jong-il. Moon pushed hard for the Trump-Kim meeting to be at Panmunjom, followed immediately by a trilateral with both Koreas and the U.S. This was largely a Moon effort to insert himself into the ensuing photo op, as we would see again in June 2019. Trump seemed swept up in the rapture, even suggesting advancing the Kim meeting to mid-May, which was logistically impossible. Fortunately, Moon conceded that Kim preferred Singapore, which helped nail down the venue. Trump said finally that Pompeo and I would work with Moon on the dates, which was reassuring. Moon had asked Kim to denuclearize in 1 year, and he had agreed, agreeably close to a time frame I had suggested. Ironically, in the months that followed, it was harder to get State to agree to a 1 year schedule than to persuade Kim. The two leaders strategized about how to proceed, and Trump asked Moon to specify what we should request from North Korea, which was quite helpful. This was clever diplomacy because whatever Moon wrote, he could hardly object if we asked for it, and if we were tougher than Moon, he had at least had his say. Moon complimented Trump's leadership. In turn, Trump pressed him to tell South Korea's media how much Trump was responsible for all this. He then spoke with Abe to strategize further about the Trump-Kim summit in light of Moon's report on his meeting with Kim. Abe repeated all the key points he had made at Mar-a-Lago, in contrast with Moon's over-optimistic perspective. Not trusting Kim, Japan wanted concrete, unambiguous commitments on both the nuclear and the abductee issues. Abe stressed to Trump that he was tougher than Obama, showing clearly that Abe thought it necessary to remind Trump of that point. I spoke later with Pompeo, then traveling in the Middle East, who listened to the Abe and Moon calls from there. The Moon call especially had been a near-death experience, I said, and Pompeo responded, having cardiac arrest in Saudi Arabia. After a few more gyrations, we settled on Singapore for the summit meeting on June 12th and 13th. On Monday morning, Trump called me about my appearances on two of the Sunday talk shows, where much of the discussion concerned North Korea. I had been very good on television, he said, but I needed to praise him more because there's never been anything like this before. After all, Moon said he would recommend Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump said, however, that he didn't like my reference to the Libya model for denuclearizing North Korea because of Muammar Gaddafi's overthrow 7 years later during the completely unrelated Middle East Arab Spring. I tried explaining that the model for non-proliferation analysts was completely removing Libya's nuclear program, not Gaddafi's subsequent unpredictable demise. History showed that I didn't get through. Trump failed to understand that the unforeseen Arab Spring, which swept dramatically through the region beginning in 2011, was the reason for Gaddafi's subsequent downfall, not his 2003 renunciation of nuclear weapons. This was not Trump's error alone. many engaged in the classic logical fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore because of this, exemplified in this sentence from a 2019 New York Times story. Libya's dictator, Muammar el-Gaddafi, was killed in 2011 after relinquishing his country's nascent nuclear program. Nonetheless, Trump ended the conversation by saying, "Great job." Ironically, Trump himself said at a later press conference that when he referred to the Libya model, he meant the total decimation of Libya. Now, that model would take place with North Korea if we don't make a deal, most likely. A few minutes after Trump made those remarks, the vice president gave me a high five and said, "He's got your back." Trump himself said, "You're clear. I fixed it." There were also significant developments on the hostage front, where we were getting increasing indications that North Korea would release 3 U.S. prisoners if Pompeo personally flew to the North to receive them and return them to America. He and I didn't like the idea of his going to Pyongyang, but freeing the hostages was sufficiently important that we decided to swallow it. Trump cared nothing about who picked up the hostages, not seeing it as an issue. Chung came to see me a third time on May 4th, providing more details on the Panmunjom meeting. He stressed that he had pushed Kim hard to agree to complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, which had long been our formulation going back to the Bush 43 administration, and would be an important rhetorical step for North Korea. According to Moon, Kim had seemed amenable in the pre-Singapore context, but Kim never made the commitment publicly. Moon urged Kim to reach a big deal with Trump, after which specifics could be discussed at working levels, stressing that whatever benefits the North might receive would come after accomplishing denuclearization. Kim, said Chung, said that he understood all this. Moon wanted to confer with Trump in Washington in mid to late May before the Trump-Kim summit, which we ultimately agreed to. Later that day, Japan's Yachi also came to my office to discuss the Moon-Kim summit, showing just how closely Japan followed the entire process. Yachi wanted to counter the euphoria emanating from Seoul, not that I was overcome by it, stressing we should not fall for the North's traditional action-for-action approach. Pompeo left for Pyongyang on Tuesday, May 8th, picked up the 3 American hostages, and returned with them to Washington, arriving at Andrews after 2 a.m. on Thursday morning. Trump greeted the returning men in an incredible, hastily arranged middle-of-the-night broadcast live arrival ceremony. The 3 released Americans were understandably exuberant, raising their arms in celebration when they exited the plane into the bright spotlights. They loved speaking to the press and were the hit of the night, enjoying, thankfully, a return from North Korea far different from that of the fatally tortured and brutalized Otto Warmbier. The Marine One flight back to the White House, passing very near the illuminated Washington Monument, was almost surreal. Trump was on cloud 9 even at 3:30 a.m. when we landed on the South Lawn, because this was a success even the hostile media could not diminish. Maneuverings for the Trump-Kim meeting continued apace. In particular, we worried about what China was doing to influence the North Koreans, and closely followed what key Chinese players like Yang Jiechi, China's former ambassador to Washington during Bush 43, former foreign minister and now state counselor, a position superior to foreign minister in China's system, were saying to their counterparts and in public. I had concerns that Beijing was setting the stage to blame the United States if the talks broke down, warning that North Korean hardliners were undercutting Kim Jong-un for releasing the American hostages without any reciprocity from the U.S. Under this scenario, there was no consensus within the system in the North, and that strong resistance from Pyongyang's military meant that the talks were in jeopardy before they even began. The answer? More preemptive concessions by the United States. This was one of the oldest games in the communist playbook, frightening gullible Westerners with tales of splits between moderates and hardliners so that we accepted otherwise unpalatable outcomes to bolster the moderates. Chung did worry about the North's recent announcement that only journalists would attend the closure of the Punggye-ri test site, not nuclear experts, as they had previously committed to. Pyongyang might just as well invite the Bobbsey twins. While this ploy was destroying something rather than building it, Grigory Potemkin's ghost was nonetheless undoubtedly celebrating his continued relevance. Chung and I were on the phone constantly over the following week preparing for Moon Jae-in's visit to Washington and the Trump-Kim-Singapore meeting. We spoke repeatedly about the Punggye-ri closure, which was pure fluff, starting with the lack of any U.S. or international site inspections, particularly examining the tunnels and underground facilities before any preparations for or detonations closing the adits, the tunnel entrances. By precluding such inspections, North Korea was concealing key information. Nuclear forensics experts, as was common practice, could have extrapolated significant conclusions about the size and scope of the nuclear weapons program, other locations in the North's nuclear gulag that we wanted disclosed and inspected, and more. We knew from the IAEA's experience in Iraq in 1991 and thereafter, which I had lived through personally during the Bush 41 administration, that there were enormous amounts of information that could be very effectively concealed without adequate, persistent, on-site inspections before, during, and after any denuclearization. Subsequent international monitoring, such as the International Atomic Energy Agency's taking soil samples outside the adits, was no substitute for inspections inside Punggye-ri Mountain, as the North fully understood. This propaganda charade was evidence not of Pyongyang's good faith, but of its unmistakable bad faith. Even CNN later characterized North Korea's approach as like trampling on a crime scene. Chung thought the issue could be raised at an inter-Korean meeting at Panmunjom later in the week, but the North canceled the meeting at the last minute, another typical Pyongyang gambit. They then expressly threatened to cancel the Trump-Kim meeting, complaining about an annual U.S.-South Korean military exercise called Max Thunder. This was another propaganda ploy, but it and later complaints about these military exercises, absolutely vital to our joint military preparedness, turned out to influence Trump beyond the North's wildest expectations. I told Trump about this North Korean eruption at about 6:30 p.m., and he said our press line should be, "Whatever the situation is fine with me. If they would prefer to meet, I am ready. If they would prefer not to meet, that is okay with me too. I will fully understand." I called again at about 7 o'clock and listened at length to Trump criticize the South Korean-U.S. military exercise. He had been against it for a year, couldn't understand why it cost so much and was so provocative. Didn't like flying B-52s from Guam to participate, and on and on and on. I couldn't believe that the reason for these exercises, to be fully ready for a North Korean attack, hadn't been explained before. If it had, it clearly hadn't registered. Competent militaries exercise frequently. Especially in an alliance, joint training is critical so that the allied countries don't cause problems for themselves in a time of crisis. "Fight tonight" was the slogan of U.S. Forces Korea, reflecting its mission to deter and defeat aggression. A decrease in readiness could mean "fight next month," which didn't cut it. As I came to realize, however, Trump just didn't want to hear about it. The exercises offended Kim Jong-un and were unnecessarily expensive. Case closed. In the meantime, we were working on logistics for Singapore. On one critical point, Pompeo suggested that he, Kelly, and I be with Trump whenever he was around Kim, to which Kelly and I readily agreed. I also worried how cohesive we would be given the daily explosions everyone became inured to in the Trump White House. One such bizarre episode in mid-May involved disparaging remarks by Kelly Sadler, a White House communications staffer, about John McCain. Her comments, dismissing McCain and how he might vote on Gina Haspel's nomination as CIA director because he's dying anyway, leaked to the press, immediately creating a storm. Trump wanted to promote Sadler, while others wanted to fire her, or at least make her apologize publicly for her insensitivity. Sadler refused and got away with it because Trump, who despised McCain, allowed her to. Sadler turned her own insensitivity into a weapon by accusing others of leaking, a frequent offensive tactic in the Trump White House. In an Oval Office meeting, Trump rewarded her with a hug and a kiss. Although this debacle was hardly my issue, I went to see Kelly at one point, figuring that surely rational people could get an apology out of this insubordinate staffer. After a brief discussion, with just the two of us in his office, Kelly said, "You can't imagine how desperate I am to get out of here. This is a bad place to work, as you will find out." He was the first to see Trump in the morning and the last to see him at night, and I could only conjecture how many mistakes he had prevented during his tenure. Kelly attacked the press, fully justifiably in my view, and said, "They're coming for you, too," which I didn't doubt. North Korea continued to threaten canceling the Trump-Kim meeting and attacked me by name. This was nothing new, dating to 2002 under Bush 43, when North Korea honored me by calling me human scum. They attacked my citing the Libya model of denuclearization. I wondered if they had a source inside the White House who knew Trump's reaction, saying, "We shed light on the quality of Bolton already in the past, and we do not hide our feelings of repugnance toward him." Of course, it was clear to everyone on our side of the negotiations that they were really denouncing the very concept of complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization. South Korea remained concerned about the North's efforts to scale back the joint military exercises. Even the dovish Moon administration understood full well the exercises were critical to their security and worried this was yet another Pyongyang effort to drive a wedge between Seoul and Washington. Chung said the North was clearly trying to split Trump away from me, relating that at the April 27th Moon-Kim meeting, several North Korean officials asked about my role in the Trump-Kim meeting. I felt honored once again. But more important, North Korea continued denouncing the joint military exercises, now attacking Moon. The present South Korean authorities have been clearly proven to be an ignorant and incompetent group. Such attacks were the North's not-so-subtle way of intimidating Moon into doing the North's work for it by pressuring us, a ploy we were determined wouldn't succeed. More seriously, Kim's chief of staff did not arrive in Singapore as scheduled on May 17th. Preparations for the North's paranoid leader were formidable, even if dwarfed by what it took for a U.S. president to make such a journey. Delay in laying the groundwork could ultimately postpone or even cancel the meeting itself. By Monday, May 21st, no North Korean advance team had arrived. Hence, there were no meetings with our team in Singapore. Trump began to wonder what was up, telling me, "I want to get out of Singapore before they do," which sounded promising. He recounted how, with the women he had dated, he never liked to have them break up with him. He always wanted to be the one doing the breaking up. "Very revealing," said Kelly when I told him later. One question was whether to cancel Singapore just as Moon Jae-in came to town or wait until he departed. I urged Trump to act now, because doing so after Moon left would seem like an explicit rebuff of Moon, which was unnecessary. Trump agreed, saying, "I may tweet tonight." At Trump's request, I spoke with Pence and Kelly, who both agreed he should tweet away. I reported this back to Trump, and Trump started dictating what his tweet might say. After several drafts, suitably retyped by Westerhout, it, or they, emerged as, "Based on the fact that dialogue has changed pertaining to North Korea and its denuclearization, I have respectfully asked my representatives to inform North Korea to terminate the June 12th meeting in Singapore. While I very much look forward to meeting and negotiating with Kim Jong-un, Perhaps we will get another chance in the future. In the meantime, I greatly appreciate the release of the three Americans who are now at home with their families." A follow-up tweet would say, "I am disappointed that China has been unable to do what is necessary, primarily at the border, meaning sanctions enforcement, to help us obtain peace." The Oval was then filling with staffers to prepare Trump for a dinner with state governors. As he left, Trump said he would probably tweet after dinner at 8 or 9 o'clock. I returned to my office to brief Pompeo, and he said, "I get it. Let's go with the strategy." I walked to Pence's office to tell him about the tweets. Both of us were very confident Trump would cancel Singapore that evening. But when we awoke the next morning, no tweets had emerged. Trump explained to Kelly later that his cell phone had not been working the night before, but he told me he wanted to let Moon have his say before canceling. So it was with a distinct lack of enthusiasm that I met Chung and his colleagues for breakfast in the wardroom to discuss the Moon-Trump meeting later in the day. The South still wanted Moon in Singapore for a trilateral after the Trump-Kim meeting. Another important topic in our discussion was a declaration ending the Korean War. I originally thought the end-of-war declaration was the North's idea, but I later started to suspect that it was Moon's, emanating from and supporting his reunification agenda, another good reason not to buy it. Substantively, the end-of-war idea had no rationale except that it sounded good. With the possibility nothing much else would emerge in Singapore, we risked legitimizing Kim Jong-un not only by having him meet with a U.S. president, but also by holding a gauzy peace summit, undermining economic sanctions by suggesting the North was no longer dangerous, and not just at the nuclear level. I was determined to stop anything legally binding and also to minimize the damage of whatever objectionable document Trump might agree to. I worried about Moon's pitching Trump on these bad ideas, but after all, I couldn't stop it. I walked to Blair House to meet Pompeo ahead of our 10 a.m. meeting with Moon, Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa, and Chung. Moon was characteristically optimistic about Singapore, and after an hour, I returned to the White House, Pompeo headed to state, to tell Trump what we had discussed. I joined one of the intelligence briefings Trump had every week from Director of National Intelligence Coates, CIA Director Haspel, and briefers who accompanied them. I didn't think these briefings were terribly useful, and neither did the intelligence community, since much of the time was spent listening to Trump rather than Trump listening to the briefers. I made several tries to improve the transmission of intelligence to Trump, but failed repeatedly. It was what it was. When I arrived from Blair House, Trump was telling the briefers he had written tweets about canceling Singapore the night before, but concluded he could wait a little bit longer, because there was still some chance it might come off, and he didn't want to cancel before the absolute last minute. It made me feel worse to see just how close we had come. Moon arrived, and the two leaders soon thereafter greeted the press hordes in the Oval. The extended questioning, mostly on China issues, substantially shortened Moon's one-on-one with Trump. After the two leaders entered the cabinet room, Trump opened by saying there was about a 25% chance the Singapore meeting would happen, which I suspect he also told Moon privately. In response, Moon stressed his support for complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization, and his optimistic view there was a 0% chance Singapore wouldn't happen. Trump was worried about appearing too anxious, but Moon hastened to assure him it was really North Korea that was anxious, since nothing like this had ever happened before. Trump said he wanted a structured meeting in Singapore, which shocked me and which didn't happen in any event. He asked why no experts were being allowed to visit Punggye-ri, and we explained that many believed, myself included, that Kim had made a verbal commitment to close the test site without really understanding what he was saying. As if things were not already messy, Nick Ayers, the VP's chief of staff, phoned in the late evening to say North Korea's Vice Foreign Minister Choi Sun-hee had issued a stinging attack on Pence, calling him a political dummy and basically threatening nuclear war because of Pence's remarks in a recent interview with Fox's Martha McCallum. Pence came on the line to suggest I tell Trump, which I set out to do immediately. After quickly obtaining and reviewing Pyongyang's full screed, I reached Trump at 10 p.m. I explained the situation and suggested we demand an apology, at least implying Singapore would be canceled without one. Trump wanted to sleep on it, which I relayed back to Pence, and which Trump also did himself. I called Pompeo at 10:25 to brief him, suggesting he join us early the next morning. As vice president, Pence maintained the strong views on national security that he'd had during his years in the House of Representatives, and I regarded him as a consistent ally. At the same time, he followed the prudent example of other vice presidents who were circumspect in their advocacy of policies without knowing first where Trump was headed. I respected the inherent difficulties of his job, believing he did much of his best work in private conversations with Trump. I went in even earlier than usual the next day, surveying the extensive Asian press coverage of the North Korean blast, but noting little U.S. coverage, probably because of the hour the statement was released. I told Kelly what had happened and said we had an 8 a.m. call with Trump in the residence. Ayers entered to say both he and Pence thought Singapore should be canceled. Kelly agreed, as did Pompeo, who had come over. We were all around the speakerphone to call Trump, and I gave a full description of the North's attack on Pence and the international and U.S. press coverage. Trump asked me to read the full text of Vice Foreign Minister Choi Sun-hee's remarks, which I did. "Jesus," said Trump. "That's strong." We all agreed that so vitriolic a statement could have come only with Kim Jong-un's express approval. This was not just some rogue official sounding off. Our critics would likely accuse us of overreacting because, after all, North Korea frequently spoke in vitriolic terms. That was true. But it was also true prior U.S. administrations had simply accepted North Korea's rhetoric without imposing consequences. That had to stop, and this was the time to do it. Trump didn't hesitate to cancel the Singapore meeting. He dictated a letter, which we took through several iterations, but which emerged as truly Trump's. The final version, edited for small corrections, went public about 9:45 a.m., followed by two presidential tweets. We also drafted a statement he could read at an already scheduled bill signing ceremony that morning, emphasizing that maximum pressure on North Korea would continue. I called Singaporean Foreign Minister Vivian Balakrishnan to tell him what was happening, catching him in Dubai while changing planes. He took the news very graciously, as he had a few weeks earlier taken the initial news that Singapore had won the prize of hosting the Trump-Kim summit. The South Koreans weren't so gracious. Chung called me in the late morning to say our cancellation was a big political embarrassment to Moon, coming right after his return trip from Washington, a trip that had raised big expectations in South Korea. I told Chung to read carefully what Choi Sun-hee had said about America's vice president, but he was not mollified, nor was Moon, who issued a watered-down version of Chung's remarks to me. Japan's Yachi, by contrast, said they were greatly relieved Singapore had been canceled. While this drama was unfolding, the North presented a little theater of its own, closing Punggye-ri in exactly the Potemkin village in reverse style we had expected. That very evening, less than 12 hours after announcing Singapore's cancellation, the roof fell in. Trump seized on a slightly less belligerent statement by a different North Korean foreign ministry official to order us to get the June 12th meeting back on schedule. This was a clear mistake in my view. An open admission Trump was desperate to have the meeting at any price, which produced media reports of head-snapping diplomacy that unnerved our friends worldwide. Of course, the media had no clue we had also almost canceled Singapore on Monday, before Trump backed away. In resurrecting the meeting, Pompeo talked to Kim Jong-chol, his counterpart in the U.S.-North Korea negotiations when he was CIA director, and decided this Kim would come to New York for further preparations. Pompeo, Kelly, and I agreed we should insist on a public statement by Kim Jong-un himself rather than relying on statements by foreign ministry officials, and that we should postpone Singapore for a month as insurance. We called Trump at about 8:50 a.m. to make these recommendations, but he wasn't having any. Instead, he rhapsodized about what an extremely warm letter, meaning North Korea's statement, we had received. He didn't want to risk the momentum we now had. I was tempted to respond, "What momentum?" But I stifled it. On he went. "This is a big win here. If we make a deal, it will be one of the greatest deals in history. I want to make him, Kim, and North Korea very successful." It was depressing. We had come so close to escaping the trap. On Saturday, we learned to our collective surprise that Moon and Kim had met for 2 hours earlier that day at the DMZ. Foreign Minister Kong told Pompeo that Kim had requested the meeting, and Moon, predictably, had immediately agreed. Chung also debriefed me, saying he had not been at the DMZ, but all had gone well, with the two leaders reaffirming agreement on complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization and other matters. Kim told Moon he expected to reach a comprehensive deal at Singapore, for which the North was making extensive preparations. Kim had been a bit surprised by Trump's decision to suspend the meeting and was very relieved the U.S. had changed its position. Moon stressed that the U.S. wouldn't accept action for action, although he then turned around and essentially implied there could be U.S. political compensation if the North made substantial progress on our concept of denuclearization, thus demonstrating, in my view, why we needed to get Moon out of the business of negotiating the issue. At the same time, my concern grew that some state working-level types would revert predictably and quickly into the failed six-party talks approach without even noticing the change from our present approach. Meanwhile, Trump was busy tweeting there was no division on his team. Unlike what the failing and corrupt New York Times would like people to believe, there is zero disagreement within the Trump administration as to how to deal with North Korea. And if there was, it wouldn't matter. The @NewYorkTimes has called me wrong right from the beginning. The next day at the DMZ, North Korea, led by the ever-pleasant Choi Soon-hee, refused in bilateral talks with the U.S. even to use the word denuclearization on the agenda for the Trump-Kim meeting. This was unhappily familiar territory, and why I worried it was only a matter of time before state began to buckle, not to mention Trump, who was so eager for success in Singapore. We were in near constant contact with our South Korean counterparts, and the pace of our preparations rose dramatically. Abe and the Japanese were also pouring it on, hoping they could hold Trump in line with his previous commitments. Abe told Trump on Memorial Day that the way he handled the summit was completely different from the way other U.S. presidents had handled them, and that Kim never expected he would dare to cancel the meeting. Trump, said Abe, was now in a position of strength, obviously hoping Trump wouldn't make his predecessor's errors. Abe pressed Trump to advocate not just our concept of denuclearization, but, reflecting Japan's long-standing positions, also dismantling Pyongyang's biological and chemical weapons programs, as well as all their ballistic missiles, whatever the ranges. I discussed the state of play with Trump the day after Memorial Day, and, unpredictably, Trump said, "We can't have a bunch of doves take over the delegation. Tell Pompeo, I'll have to take this deal over. We've got to discuss denuclearization in the Singapore communique. Got to have it." Then he said, "Get the leader of the delegation on the phone," which we did quickly, speaking to a very surprised American Foreign Service officer in Seoul. After initial pleasantries, Trump said, "I'm the one to sell the deal. You shouldn't negotiate denuclearization, and you should tell them that. You have to say denuclearization with no wiggle room. Trump allowed as how he didn't want a big formal agenda and wanted no great formality. That was that. A few minutes later, Pompeo called, upset Trump had spoken directly with the delegation. I explained what had happened, including my concern about weak language in the draft communique. I'm right with you on that, said Pompeo, meaning we had to discuss denuclearization, but it was not clear he realized states' negotiators were not right with us on holding the line in the negotiations. Pompeo then told me Trump wanted to bring Kim Jong-chol to meet in the Oval Office, which Trump thought was genius. We both thought it was a mistake, as did Kelly when I briefed him, although Pompeo seemed resigned to it. About then, I wondered if I should just recede from the North Korea issue and let Trump own it, instead of constantly fighting rearguard actions and wild Trump policy swings. On the other hand, we were dealing with nuclear weapons in the hands of a bizarre regime, as I saw it, so I was reluctant to turn my back on it or resign. Trump personally still seemed undecided about whether he wanted Singapore to happen. As we discussed strategy before Pompeo left for New York to meet Kim Jong-chol, he went back and forth before concluding, I would rather have it, Singapore, than not have it. But if we don't get denuclearization, we can't do anything else. He said, if the meeting fails, I would impose massive tariffs. Either he meant sanctions, or he was referring to China, not North Korea. I have decided to delay them for now, but they are waiting. Then came the bottom line. I want to go. It will be great theater. There was no discussion of Kim Jong-chol's coming to the White House, and Pompeo and I agreed as we walked out of the Oval that we might yet escape. That, unfortunately, overlooked the lesser Kim, who, as Pompeo said to Kelly and me shortly after 9 p.m. that evening, was hell-bent on getting in front of Trump to hand him a letter from Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-chol was also obdurate on all the substantive issues. The only good news was that he had no use for Moon and no interest in a trilateral summit. This was between us, with no need for the South Koreans. We got Trump on the line, Pompeo reported on the dinner, and we came finally to Kim Jong-chol's desire to hand him Kim Jong-un's letter. Very elegant, Trump exclaimed. Let's do it. Kelly and I explained why we opposed it, but to no avail. Neither arguments about the potential political impact nor about Kim Jong-chol himself, a brutal killer, and the man very likely personally responsible for the effectively fatal torture of Otto Warmbier, made a dent. We tried later with the vice president's agreement, at least to move the meeting out of the Oval Office, but that didn't work either. I dug out a picture of Bill Clinton sitting in the Oval with two North Korean generals to show Pyongyang had played this game before, and even that didn't work. States diplomatic security people drove the lesser Kim from New York for the 1 p.m. Oval meeting with Trump. We met to brief Trump, and Pence tried again to persuade him to hold it somewhere else, such as the diplomatic reception room. Trump wasn't listening. In fact, he began musing about taking Kim Jong-chol to the Lincoln bedroom, which we also tried to talk him out of. I collected the U.S. interpreter and walked over to the residence's south entrance, where Kelly was already waiting to meet the North Koreans and escort them to the Oval. While we were there, a Secret Service agent told me the president wanted me back in the Oval. I was puzzled, but downright amazed when I walked into the Oval and ran into Pence, who said neither he nor I would be in the meeting with Kim. I could tell from both Pence and Ayers that they were somewhat in shock, and Ayers said Trump wanted to keep the meeting small. It would just be Trump, Pompeo, and the interpreter on the U.S. side, and Kim and his interpreter on theirs. There would be the absolute minimum number of people present to hear what Trump said. By this time, Trump was in a near frenzy, piling up standard-issue White House gifts, such as cufflinks, to give away. One box was slightly creased, and Trump told Madeleine Westerhout harshly, "You've ruined this one. Get another one." He then berated the White House official photographer, whom he wanted to stay only briefly while Kim Jong-chol was there. I had never seen Trump so wrought up. Pence said to me, "Why don't you hang out in my office?" which was generous. Neither of us thought that handing over Kim Jong-un's letter would take more than a few minutes. I was still stunned at being excluded, but not more stunned than Pence, who was stoical throughout. Kim Jong-chol arrived at 1:15, and Kelly escorted him to the Oval along the colonnade. Kelly told us later that Kim seemed very nervous, and just as they entered the West Wing, he remembered he had left Kim Jong-un's letter in the car. The North Korean interpreter was sent racing back to retrieve it. One can only imagine Kim Jong-chol thinking about how to explain to the great successor that he had forgotten his letter. In the VP's office, we watched the television as the press on the South Lawn desperately tried to see what was happening inside. Time dragged, to say the least. We had one light moment when Don McGahn came to tell us that Trump's gifts were almost certainly sanctions violations, which he would have to retroactively waive. As McGahn said frequently, this was not the Bush White House. The meeting finally ended at 2:45. Trump and Pompeo emerged from the Oval with Kim Jong-chol and walked him to the driveway where his cars were waiting, and then Trump spoke to the press on his way back to the Oval. Once we saw that Kim had left the Oval, Pence and I went in, and Kelly gave me the original and a rough translation of Kim Jong-un's letter to Trump, saying, "This is the only copy." The letter was pure puffery, written probably by some clerk in North Korea's agitprop bureau, but Trump loved it. This was the beginning of the Trump-Kim bromance. The first family was going to Camp David for the weekend, and they had all assembled to walk to Marine One, which had landed in the interim. Trump smiled and gave me a thumbs up as he left the Oval again. The rest of us repaired to Pence's office, where Kelly and Pompeo debriefed us. Kim Jong-chol had said nothing new or different about the North's position. Clearly, what they wanted were political assurances before agreeing to any denuclearization, and Trump had seemed inclined to give them just that. Strikingly, as in earlier discussions with the North, economic sanctions seemed to be secondary. This probably meant that North Korea feared U.S. military power more than it feared economic pressure, and also quite likely indicated that sanctions weren't as effective as we thought. Kelly said the North could have come away with any impression they wanted regarding what Trump might do. Trump had said he was willing to reduce the U.S.-South Korean military exercises and had gone off on a riff about how expensive and provocative they were. This may have been the worst point, because North Korea had now just heard from America's commander-in-chief that our military capabilities on the peninsula were up for negotiation, despite our earlier denials. This was a concession that could upset even Moon Jae-in and his sunshine policy advocates, whose calculations rested on a strong U.S. presence. To many people, it was the U.S. presence that allowed the South Korean political left to engage in the fantasy of the sunshine policy to begin with. If we ever left Korea, they would be effectively on their own and would feel the consequences of their foolishness, which I believed they themselves feared. As bad as it sounded, I felt we could walk Trump back off the ledge, so perhaps no real damage had been done. How could this meeting have lasted for an hour and 15 minutes? Consecutive translation was one answer, but in truth, any meeting with Trump could last that long or longer. "I'm a talker," I heard him say several times during my tenure. "I like to talk." What to do next? Kelly said he thought Trump was ready for the possibility nothing would happen in Singapore. I thought that was optimistic. We talked about establishing a timeline to show we didn't have forever to play this out, all while North Korea was still developing and/or manufacturing nuclear components and ballistic missiles. We broke up around 3:45, and I returned to my office. To my surprise, at around 4:10, my phone rang and a voice said, "This is the Camp David switchboard," the first time I had ever heard that greeting. The operator said the president wanted to speak to me. "The letter was very friendly, don't you think?" he asked, and I agreed, although I also said it was non-substantive. "It's a process," said Trump. "I understand that now. We'll just have a meeting to get to know each other, and then we'll see what happens. It will take longer than I first thought." I stressed my view that neither sanctions relief nor an end of the Korea War declaration should come until complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization was concluded, which was what the administration's policy always had been. He seemed to be amenable to this analysis and advice. I said that having the discussions play out over time was acceptable with one major qualification. Time was almost always on the side of the proliferator, and simply running the clock had long been a central part of North Korea's strategy. Our time was not indefinite, which he seemed to accept. "It was pretty good," he concluded, and the call ended. In fact, Trump got precisely what he wanted from the press. The headlines were effectively, "June 12th meeting in Singapore, back on." Over the weekend, I briefed Chung about the Kim Yong-chol meeting, and he said Moon was just delighted by the outcome. Unknowingly echoing Trump, Chung also said that we were facing a process, not just one meeting in Singapore. That was exactly what I had feared their reaction would be. Meanwhile, at the bilateral U.S.-North Korea talks in the DMZ, the North rejected our draft approach to Singapore. The State Department, faced with rejection, wanted to offer a compromise, in effect saying, "You don't like that one? How about this one?" And if the North didn't like this one, the state negotiators would probably offer them another one, all the while, in reality, negotiating with themselves to see if they could produce a smile from the North Koreans. I had seen it many times before. Fortunately, Pompeo agreed with my view that we should produce no new drafts but wait for Pyongyang to respond to ours. The North finally commented verbally on our draft and said they would provide written comments the next day. Amazing how that works. I also pushed to get the negotiations moved to Singapore to get the North Koreans out of their DMZ comfort zone. After a struggle with the U.S. delegation more than with the North, we did so. Even Chung agreed it was time this movable feast arrived in Singapore. I then decided to confront the growling press speculation I was being cut out of North Korea matters and would not go to Singapore. I told Kelly, "I've been around this track a few times before, and I didn't think my exclusion from the Kim Yong-chol meeting was accidental." Kelly said he was surprised I wasn't in the room when he walked into the Oval with Kim in tow. I explained what Pence had said and why we had gone to the VP's office without my asking Trump directly why we wouldn't be included. Kelly said he hadn't expected to be in the meeting either, but Trump had asked him to stay. I recounted the speculation I would not be going to Singapore, which, if true, meant I couldn't do my job and would accordingly resign. Kelly said, "I wouldn't have expected you to say anything else," and he said he would talk to Trump, which I accepted as a first step. Later that morning, Kelly reported that Trump had meant nothing by not having me in the Kim Yong-chol meeting and that I would be in all the Singapore meetings. That satisfied me for the moment. Immediately after his lunch with Trump that day, June 4th, Mattis came in to discuss the Trump-Kim summit, stressing he was worried about the squishiness of our position on the North's nuclear program, and asked, given the press speculation, if I was going to Singapore. When I said yes, Mattis said, "Good," emphatically, explaining he was sure, in his assessment, that Japan and several other key states in the region all supported my position not to lift sanctions before complete denuclearization, which showed the extent of backing for our approach. I wondered at this conversation because, for the first time, I sensed Mattis was uncertain and nervous. I didn't understand why until Ayers told me a few days later that Trump had spent much of the lunch with Mattis, according to what he had heard, beating up on him, for among other things being a Democrat, in ways no one had ever seen before. Mattis had to know what that meant. This was something to watch. On Tuesday, June 5th, Pompeo and I had lunch with Trump, one important topic of which was Moon's continuing desire to be present in Singapore, which was a topic that had already broken out into the Asian press because of leaks in South Korea. Both Pompeo and I explained to our counterparts in Seoul what our thinking was. The bad news at lunch was Trump's fascination with the prospect he could say he had ended the Korean War. I didn't mind selling that concession to the North at some point, but I thought we certainly shouldn't give it away for free, which Trump was ready to do. It simply didn't matter to him. He thought it was just a gesture, a huge media score, and didn't see any international consequences. After lunch, Pompeo and I walked to my office. We decided we had to develop something to offer as an alternative, but no good ideas popped up. I knew that Japan would be particularly disturbed that we might make this concession, so I couldn't wait to hear what Yachi would say to me during yet another Washington visit that afternoon. I also took the opportunity to ask Pompeo if he had some issue with me, as media stories were alleging. He said flatly that he did not, recalling how just in the past few days, I had helped him stop an errant U.S. ambassador from making an appointment with Trump directly without seeking permission from him. Pompeo at the time had said, "Bless you, John," at which we both laughed. Whether even at this early stage there was more to it than that, I can't say, but there didn't appear to be. When Pompeo and I had breakfast in the wardroom the next morning, Mattis being out of the country yet again, we discussed what to extract from North Korea in return for an end-of-war communique, including perhaps a baseline declaration of their nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. I doubted the North would agree or agree on any of our other ideas, but it might at least prevent a gratuitous U.S. concession ending the Korean War. Later that day, Prime Minister Abe stopped briefly in Washington on his way to the annual G7 summit, held that year in Charlevoix, Canada, to press Trump one more time not to give away the store. Abe stressed that the North Koreans are survivors, saying, "They have staked their lives on their system. They are very tough, very shrewd politicians. If they think this is business as usual, they will go back to their old ways." Although the two leaders had a good conversation on Pyongyang, trade issues were not so sunny, with long rifts by Trump on the unfair trade deficits, especially since the U.S. had agreed to defend Japan. "We defend you by treaty. We defend you, but not the other way around. We had bad negotiators, right, John?" he asked, looking at me. "We'll defend you without a treaty," Trump continued, but said, "It's not fair."